Hi, everyone. Welcome back to my podcast series. You're listening to Welcome to the Winner's Circle. On this episode, I have a special guest. Her name is Stephanie Wellens, and we are going to just talk a little bit about re-Africanization of the Black family and African pedagogy and all those good things when it comes to education and curriculum. So Stephanie, good evening, and thank you for joining on the episode. How are you?
Thank you so much, Tamika, for allowing me to engage with you in this important discussion. And I definitely feel like a winner in the winner's circle.
Oh, thank you.
I appreciate that. I am feeling wonderful and just ready to mindscape with you.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So, guys, just a little bit of background information. I met Stephanie in Justin Blue's book club, and currently she is getting her PhD in sociology. And just from the things that we talked about that evening in the book club, a lot of it resonated with me, especially in regards to me and what I do for work. If you all know me personally, you know that I am a school administrator. And so this is something that what we talked about that Sunday was something that just resonated with me. And I just wanted to expand on it with her a little bit. So, Stephanie, do you want to kind of give a little bit of background about yourself and introduce yourself to everyone?
Sure. Peace, everyone. So as Tamika mentioned, my name is Stephanie Wellens, and I am currently working on my PhD in sociology. I am presently working on my dissertation project, which focuses on Black homeschooling motivations, more specifically looking at why Black parents decide to homeschool their children and really exploring families who aim to re-Africanize their children, which means to help their children acquire an African ancestral culture and identity for African liberation. And so, as you can see, there's this process of identity change. And that's really kind of like the, really a cornerstone of my research is identity. Mm-hmm. Two other areas that I'm interested in, obviously, are education and racism. And so looking at racism, education, and identity, and how those intersect, and how we as Black people in particular have resisted racism. I would say before, as part of my background too, I think it's important for me to mention, before this, I was teaching sociology for a few years at Aiken Technical College. And the reason why that experience is so significant is that not only did I relearn what sociology is through my teaching, especially having to teach it from an introductory level, but it helped to formulate the sort of research that I'm doing now based on my own lived experiences as being a Black woman faculty in the South. Mm-hmm. Before that, I earned my master's degree in sociology from the University of Notre Dame and was a first generation college student getting my bachelor's degrees in psychology and sociology at Georgia State. So lots of school training didn't really mean that I was educated until about 2 years ago when I started embarking on my own self-education process.
Right. And do you want to talk a little bit about that education journey, your personal educational journey? What does that mean?
Oh, yes. Oh, wow. So as I mentioned, I used to teach and thoroughly enjoyed it. Never tutored a student before, never taught online before, and did all of those things for the first time, you know, in that position. In fact, I never even took an online class until this whole COVID thing happened. So, but fortunately, made a lot of strides and improvement and was able to connect with one of my students' grandparents. This student would record my lectures. And I guess his grandma used to help him with his assignments. And she was, interested to meet me. Mm-hmm. And she came to my office and she said, you know what, next year, I want you to come to my church and do a speech on Black history.
Wow, that's and nice.
It was so deep. I was like, okay, never did anything like that. And quite frankly, going back to what I alluded to earlier, which is this distinction between schooling and education.
Right.
I was highly schooled, but not educated on our history as Black African people. And so once I started diving into the history in preparation for the speech, it was like my soul opened up and my African consciousness was able to recenter. Mm-hmm. It was like I was regaining myself, regaining my African consciousness. It was waking up.
Right.
And so as I prepped for that speech and had that underway, we can fast forward past that and get to that following summer. That's when I really started diving into some of our ancestors' work, like Dr. Hilliard, Dr. John Henry Clark, Dr. Sharshi McIntyre, and others.
Mm-hmm.
So it started with preparing for a speech about us. And I didn't know that it would lead to such transformation. I mean, right. Yeah, it's a whole story behind that.
I can imagine, like, you know, just wanting to be prepared. So it would kind of, I don't want to say require you, but it would kind of, I would say, nudge you, give you like a little bit of a nudge to kind of dig deep and research. And so you know what you're saying when you do give that. And that most likely just opened the doors for you to like dig a little deeper, even yeah. more. And so that was important to you, that spiritual journey and just how that was kind of started and how you're just on it now. And mm-hmm. that has, I'm sure, affected your choice and, you know, homeschooling and, you know, educational curriculums and traditional mm-hmm. schooling, traditional educational curriculums. What do you want to say about homeschooling? What exactly is homeschooling, you know, in your definition, versus regular education?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think one thing that's important to state about homeschooling is that homeschooling typically is not a mere replica mm-hmm. of what happens in institutionalized schooling.
Right.
There's a lot of flexibility. There's a lot of change. There's a lot of creativity and innovation that can happen in the curriculum as well as the pedagogy.
Right.
So homeschooling is not really school at home.
Right, right.
but I would say that typically homeschooling is generally defined as educating your child independent of a traditional or institutionalized school structure, whether that be a charter school, a Montessori, or mm-hmm. Or like a public or private institution of sort. Like, right. So that's important, but I think it's also necessary for me to mention that there are different types of homeschooling forms
okay.
that I'm learning about through my research on homeschooling.
Okay.
You have folks who homeschool their children part-time. You have folks who homeschool their children with the assistance of like a private tutor.
Mm-hmm.
You have folks who are just having partnerships with actual like institutional schools for resources and things. So it complicates the definition, but I think right. just for clarity and consistency for me, it's, you know, right. you are independent of those institutions.
You know, that's interesting. Cause honestly, I've never known like there was actual levels to homeschooling like that. Mm-hmm. And what you had just mentioned and just what I do for my work, you know, being a school administrator, I do come across families when it comes to admissions and enrollment in regards to, you know, they say, oh, we don't need a full week program like Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. We're interested in maybe 2 days out the week. The other 3 days, we homeschool and we have somebody come and help or they do this or they homeschool with like other families in like small little groups. Or they're saying like, you know, we'll be homeschooling, but do you have resources that we can actually use? You know, so I find that interesting. And yeah, I don't see it too much in the Black community. That's something I don't see too much in the Black community, but definitely I feel like everyone else is practicing that. And that is definitely something that I think is passed down. I don't really think it's something that you wake up one day and you're like, oh, I'm going to do this. You know, it's something that you've either seen yourself or you've experienced it, or your mother or your grandparents or whoever, who an elder in your family has told you like, oh, you should do this. So I find that pretty interesting when it comes to the levels of homeschooling and just what those models look like. So now when it comes to schooling in general versus education, we know that education was something that was like, in a sense, like self-taught, like your growth, your personal growth. What would you say schooling is?
Yeah, so schooling is, you know, and from my view and based on my experience, is the exact opposite of education.
Right.
Education, as you mentioned, is supposed to bring about a personal spiritual transformation where you are really, in essence, especially from an African-centered view, you are transforming from a material human being, a flesh-based being, into a spiritual, ethereal, cosmic being. It's like you evolve into your higher self. What I've noticed based on schooling is that it prevents you from being able to reconnect with your higher self.
Right.
Because it has you so trained for the material world. I got to get this piece of paper, this material called a certificate
or right. degree, right.
for this material job to make material money and then get my material house. And so it really truncates your whole life experience and what you think is living. You're not. You're living according to someone else's definition as well as their own interest to be able to benefit off of you being trained like schools of fish, so to speak.
Right, right.
Schooling is it's an indoctrination and it's a training. But because we exist in a system that is hierarchical, meaning that we're ranked,
right.
we have inequality and historical disparities, then that means that we, you know, we're oh, my mind just went blank. Because I thought I heard my little one. But because we live in this sort of unequal system, schooling is sorting us to different places to benefit those who are in control. And so I think there's a power and a constraint dynamic that comes with schooling that is not with education, where education is predicated on being free, being liberated, being
right.
able to explore without boundaries.
Right.
So, yeah, so it's, that is a very, I'm very passionate about that distinction.
Yeah, I would say too, like with traditional schooling, it definitely is, it's almost in a sense, like an unspoken rule. Like what you're learning in school is law, and like this is right and it can't be wrong and you can't question it. And, you know, you're literally taught not to question the teacher. Or if you just see something like, let's say, a science book or a history book or what have you, and you're just kind of questioning that, like, well, this isn't right, or this is not what happened, or I have a book at home that says something totally different. You're kind of looked at like, well, you shouldn't say anything, or just it's not received on the teaching end. And it's kind of, you know, you could be right as well, you know, but you'll be penalized for it. And it's almost too, like, if it's not in the school books, then it didn't happen. you know? So it makes you wonder, you know, when you think about this whole education system here in the States, and I'm sure it's like this in other countries as well. You have to think about like who wrote these books, and, you know, they're always going to write it in the light that they're in their best light. I think that's something that some people are starting to wake up to. Not everybody, but it is something definitely that people need to just kind of be aware of and pay attention to. I completely agree too. Like that whole education piece about, you know, yourself, you know, on your journey and just finding out who you are, and a lot of what you learn about yourself and just, you know, how to deal with other people is through experience. And you're not really taught that in school too much. You might touch upon it in school when you're in high school and you're about to graduate and they say you're going into the real world when you graduate now. You know, you might touch a little bit on that aspect of it. But I think when you're on your solo journey by yourself, that's when you do get that true education, because you're applying your experiences, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah.
In a sense, overall too, like schooling, traditional schooling is linked to a dependency, where it is, you know, you have to know this information in order to do this, and it makes you dependent upon it. And not saying that, you know, science and math isn't important, because it is important. I personally feel like the science and the math is like a worldwide universal language of itself. You know, you can go anywhere in the world and you not speak the same language, but you guarantee that if you know the science or you know the math, you guys will be great. You know, now they're changing the math and everything, and I'm like, why? But
changing it how?
They are doing something called Common Core. So like just the basics, when it comes to like multiplication and just new methods of approach to solving problems. Uh-huh. I mean, it works. You get the same answer. It's just a different angle of thinking on how to figure it out.
That's so deep, because you hit on something. You said it's the thinking.
Right.
It's a different way of thinking. And that is why education is so is such a site of struggle and conflict. Because if you can control a system of education, you are influencing the minds, the consciousness, the awareness, the thought, and the reasoning, how one reasons, how one comes to get to know what it is that they think they know.
You're in
control of that process. And so you can look at it from a psychological view and start pulling in like cognition and all of that. Mm-hmm. You can look from a societal view, where education is being used to affirm so-called white supremacy.
Right.
And so education is just about that. It's about the mind. And you hit directly on that. And so it's really deep. It makes me question why a change
in
the reasoning process when it comes to this universal language called math.
Right.
Oh my gosh. Who instituted this? And what is their political affiliation?
I know.
Reason being is because in 2010, the state of, we know that Texas and California are our two largest states. Mm-hmm. And it's usually their votes from political officials who dictate what information goes into our children's primary and secondary school textbooks.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So like, because these are the two largest states, they often have a broad influence on the information that we might receive, or I might receive here in Georgia,
compared to
wherever you are. So you can begin to see how, from a sociological view, how there are different institutions that are interconnected with one another to maintain this system of inequality. We got the state, we got education, you know. And so, but you went there on something, and that is that is why I homeschool personally and why there are a lot of other Black parents deciding to do so. That's one of the major reasons, just what you said.
Yeah, it's, and I never even really thought about it that deep either, but you're absolutely right when it does come to that thinking aspect and why whoever initiated this change to think, to influence children at that, influence children thinking, why that even came about, you know, what was wrong with the old math, you know, it's deeper than that, but, you know, just for surface stuff, like what was wrong with the old math, you know, but, yeah, I completely agree with you there too. It is something that you can, there are, definitely are layers that you can peel back and kind of just see what else is lingering beneath. Yeah, I've noticed too that in terms of like when you do schooling, and I know somebody had also brought this up that evening in the book club. She was saying like, depending where you live and the school that you're in, you're, from a young age, you're kind of taught like your destiny is like chosen for you. So, you know, if you're, let's say you're in the ghetto and you're in public school in the ghetto and they've just got people coming into the school, they can, you know, oh, you'll be a great mailman when you get older, or you'll be a great delivery person, or, you know, you'll be, you know, a great city worker, you know, whatever that may be, construction worker. And like, they're all important jobs. But it's presented in a way of already, you know, giving you the short end of the stick in terms of elevating yourself higher, you know? You know, why don't you say you could own your own business, or you can, I don't know, be a pilot, or, you know, so many other things. But it's just always those jobs that people deem less important or less favorable or less desirable, sometimes even less respectable, depending where you are. And yeah, it's something that I noticed as well, that it is on purpose, majority in these, in our Black communities. And it's kind of one of those things too, again, because children's minds are so influential, like they're just, they soak up things like a sponge. They don't know the difference of what you're doing to them. But when they soak this up and it's just in their head and in their head and in their head consistently, it becomes their thinking. God, yeah, it's very deep. But that is the thing with schooling. And I could see, I can definitely see now how a lot of people want to go back to their roots and Africanizing their children's curriculum and just kind of tapping back into that way in nature and just that hands-on learning and just, you know, that would, that's somewhat seen as the strength of the Black family unit. And that's something that is important. You know, it's very important. It's always important, but it's something that's, I think it's, in my personal opinion, especially now, is important. It's something that is definitely being challenged at every angle. So let's see. So now, you know, let's say you go through the schooling model, you know, you did your elementary school, you did your middle school and graduating high school. And now when you graduate high school, you know, they expect you to figure out who you are and to tap into yourself and just your 4 years of college and have all the answers and to graduate and just contribute your piece to society. And I think that is about the only time, I mean, it's not enough time, but that is kind of like what society has allotted to be the only time for you to kind of tap into who you truly are. And that, I find that interesting as well. You know, some, depending where you are and what high schools you're in and, you know, the advantages, sometimes in high school, you might have a little bit of an outlet so you can get a feel for it and get like your feet warm and those kind of things about who you are and what you want to contribute to society and your role in humanity. But it's not, you know, on a, I want to say on a global scale, it's something that's not really highlighted until you graduate high school. That's when you think about it and that's when you're trying to figure it out. So that's also something interesting about the schooling model. And then it's, you know, seen as if you don't finish college and you drop out, or let's say you finish college and you graduate, but you don't have, you know, that job secured or that job lined up after, right away after, it's almost like you, not that you're a failure, but you didn't hold up your end of the bargain. Mm-hmm. So something interesting else, you know, something else that I found interesting when it comes to schooling and just looking at things. And I think now that I'm an adult and I see things from a parental view and I see things from like a school administrator's view, because I work in early childhood as well. So I know that, you know, and I have children of my own. So from both views of it, I see just how impressionable children are. And that basic foundation, especially in those early years, are pretty much very critical into shaping who they are and who they'll become. Another interesting piece, too, about traditional school models is we also spoke about this that Sunday in the book club, mm-hmm. was, you know, self-regulation versus punishment and, you know, meditation versus detention. And, you know, now I'm starting to see a lot more schools are saying like, okay, we're not going to call detention. We're going to call it reflection. Oh, you know, mm-hmm. Or they won't really call it meditation, but, you know, and mm-hmm. I find that interesting as well, because it's like, okay, well, if you're going to not call it detention, to not make it sound so harsh, or, you know, mm-hmm. you're really just kind of singling people out and calling them rebels or whatever, but you're calling it reflection. Are you really reflecting, though? You know,
exactly.
And probably not. I don't think so, but no. It sounds better.
You actually, that's another important point you bring up too, about the changes in these concepts, mm-hmm. you know, okay, we're going to go from detention to reflection, just like we go from difference to diversity.
Right.
Okay. So, it's a lot of these code words. And I think, you know, it's really important for folks who, you know, to not be so quick to take these concepts for granted and not question what is happening behind this label, behind this smoke screen. Let's just lift this thing up and see what's really going on.
Right. Right.
And I have my own, I'm really big on language. I'm really big on words and how powerful they are and what they represent and don't represent. Mm-hmm. I even like words like minority, you know,
right.
It's another word, and just really being able to trace the evolution of these words, like why at this moment in time, right, in this particular context, why would they switch it from detention to reflection, right, and difference to diversity? You know, is mm-hmm. what's going on in the broader context? Is it, you know, the diversity concept coming in because of, you know, the Civil Rights Act of, you know, in 64, like really attaching changes in these concepts to changes in our actual context is very powerful, because it already will dispel any sort of myth about what people are saying it is and right. what it really is.
Right. No, I agree. And I also feel too that misinformation for the child or the teenager who may be doing this quote unquote reflection, and they're not really getting an understanding of what it really should be. And I think that's also, you know, something else that's important is we're going to inform the kids, or are you going to change something that has to do with the children or do with the youth? They need to be taught the reasoning behind it, or the definition behind it, or what is the point of it really? I do agree, though. I personally do feel like when it comes to the children who, I don't want to say who act up, because maybe they have a different way of learning that's not normal. And so to us, it may seem like acting up, when really it's just they need another approach. But those children who may be in detention or in reflection, you know, I think it's important that we do include meditation in that. Like, if it's going to be a reflection, it should truly be a reflection in that, you know, a meditation and really digging deep into why some children may do that, specific behaviors or things like that, because it'll allow them to grow and understand that they have a responsibility and that they need to take accountability for their actions and thoughts. You know, they're the only ones in control of that. And I think when they learn to master themselves in that, at that level, you know, you can just see a generation of children just coming out of it, being more aware of their surroundings and their spaces, and more caring, because they'll be more in touch with themselves, and, you know, it'll spill over to being in touch with other people and just caring about other people.
I think the challenge with the reflection piece, as much as I would encourage mm-hmm. that approach for young ones, right. is that it's not consistent with where they're probably actually living, you know?
Yeah.
So,
right.
How much reflection is going on in their home? How much reflection is going on in their community? You know, are the police reflecting during moments of racial profiling? Like,
no, they're not.
You know,
they're just on a roll. They're not reflecting anything.
And I think, and quite frankly, I feel like it's insulting to change concepts from detention to reflection as if kids don't really
mm-hmm.
recognize what's going on.
Right.
I think that children are very perceptive. They're very aware and they're very keen. And even though they may not understand, you know, definitional terms, I think that they recognize fake when they see it.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that's in part where you might even have children who act up, is that I don't want to sit in a deceptive space.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right. They always say that. I saw this meme on Instagram or Facebook where it was like, the older you get, the more you realize that black sheep of the family, or the family who was quote unquote the weirdo, why they were the way they were, because they were kind of the, I don't want to use the term woke because it's such a fad now, but they were kind of the ones who were just more like, you know, they had their eyes open and they were like, okay, I can see right through the fakeness. I can be like, you know, so it's pretty interesting to think about it in terms of like at child level. And that could be why they misbehave, depending on what that environment is like. And they just don't have the full language or vocabulary to just kind of be like, I don't want to be here. You know?
Exactly. Or I'm tired of reading these books that don't reflect any of
right.
me. And when I do see me, I'm seeing myself being disparaged and being degraded and less than, or I only amount to these few black historical figures that we talk about every February, but where are the rest of us?
Right.
I mean, when we're totaling what, probably like a billion and plus around the world, like there has to be more to us, you know? So that's, I feel like in many cases we make us like, not we, meaning like me mm-hmm. and you, but just approaches to children are so individualistic, as if it's something wrong with them, like it's you.
Right.
But when in fact we are constraining the learning of the and the freedom of education. And I feel like it's honestly it's so violent because children are eager to learn.
Yeah.
As soon as they come out of the womb, they want to learn. They're soaking up. They're touching everything. Let me touch this. Let me taste that. They're trying to learn. They're trying to acquire and gain awareness. They're trying to expand their consciousness in this space.
Right.
But in those traditional schools, you don't have that freedom. Hey, okay, you got 5 minutes to get from that bath to get to that bathroom.
Right.
Okay, you got 15, 20 minutes for recess. Like, you know, so there is no time for you to get dirt in your hair and in your eyes, because by the time you wipe it off, it's time for you to go back.
Right.
It's no, you know, it's not, they don't allow latitude for children.
Right.
And so Imagine coming into a world where all you want to do is learn, but you feel like you're being punished to do it. So the very gift that you have is like you're being punished for even having it.
Yeah, that can be discouraging.
Yeah,
definitely.
Very.
So let's touch a little bit on active learning and passive learning. I know we talked a little bit about that before, but can you explain it just a little bit more for me? Because I didn't know exactly what it was. I had an idea, but not exactly.
I'm about passive and active learning?
Yeah.
So I would say passive learning is really being, so when you talk about these different learning styles, it's almost like you have to talk about how the instruction is being delivered, mm-hmm. like what the pedagogy looks like for a passive learner versus an active
right.
learner. You know, for a passive learner, it kind of follows that banking concept model that Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Press, talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have the supposed expert and knowledgeable intellectual person standing before you just dumping information into your mind as if you have nothing to contribute to the knowledge production process.
Right.
And that, you know, you're only being tasked with regurgitating or retrieving that information, that knowledge, you know, when you're called to do so vis-a-vis tests.
Like memory, so, based off of memory, like how much can you remember about this?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's very passive. You know, you just sit there, you take in, you regurgitate, and you keep doing that in like a more routinized fashion. But active learning is, you know, when you're able to engage, really, in my view, it's when you're able to engage multiple senses. You know, you're moving,
right.
You're drawing, you're even engaging your lived experience as an active process,
right.
Especially from a sociological view where we talk a lot about social actors. Mm-hmm. Well, if we're exacting our behavior in a way that's affecting some sort of change, then we are being active in that process. And I feel like in an active learning situation, you would have people who are not just sitting, but instead actively engaging with whatever the discussion is, whatever the concept is. So it presumes for active learning that learners are, learners have their own way of knowing and that they're not being controlled in how one comes to know and demonstrates what they know.
Okay.
Passive is just that.
Right.
You know, and active is you are engaging on multiple.
Right. Levels. So the passive thing is more of like a memory game, like what can you remember and that kind of thing, just kind of getting the information, holding it, and kind of like, okay, I know this. And then the active learning is more just like, okay, I know this, but I know this because I've done this part of it, I've done that part of it, and okay.
Or even when you think about like service oriented, mm-hmm. Just imagine having like a service oriented assignment where you have to go out, let's say, for example, to a soup kitchen, and you are critically observing your surroundings, your context, and you're looking at who's there. Okay, how many Black folks, how many white
right.
folks, you know, how many men, how many women? And so that's an active learning process. You're immersed in some sort of environment. Mm. You're interacting with it. You're smelling it. You're seeing it. You're touching it. Like all of your senses
right.
are being engaged. So I guess one could say that there are levels to active learning, you know, but that is an example of like a highly active learning situation.
Okay. Okay.
Directly in that space or like on the conversation of like homeschooling, taking your children to the zoo or museums, things of that sort is an active
right.
learning process.
Okay.
Yes. Breaking out of that box.
Yeah. Okay. I got a clearer understanding. That's kind of what I thought, but I was like, I'm not really too sure. I didn't want to really. Yeah.
When did you hear me mention that?
It was during the book club. I forget what were we talking about, because I'm going to see if I can find it, because every time we have a book club session, I do take notes. I don't know if anybody else in the book club does, but I do, because Justin always just has gems and he's got great people all the time. I feel like it was mentioned, you know what? It was mentioned when we were just talking about the, I want to say, you know, I can't find it in my notes. I just remember the conversation. I can't find it in my notes, but it was just when we were talking about, like, who controls the knowledge that's being fed in the education system, well, in the schooling system, who controls that knowledge and, you know, who's putting that knowledge out. So who's the one putting the stamp on it? Like, okay, stamp on it. You can teach the kids this. We're going to X this out. We're not teaching them that. And, that's kind of where that came up. And also just, you know, so when it comes to our black children, when they are being schooled and they're getting, you know, fed certain information, it was surrounded by the conversation of allowing them to see themselves in the information as well. So I think with that conversation, it was something about, like, the Pythagorean theorem, you know, you can be in school learning about this. And, you know, I mean, everybody who's learned about it, I mean, I've even said it, like, why do I need to know this? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not an architect. I'm not building pyramids and all that good stuff. But, you know, it's something that still had to be learned because somebody said so somewhere down the line. It's just been passed on for generations and generations. But also it was more something like, we're learning about the Pythagorean theorem, but who was Pythagoras? But then who taught Pythagoras, you know? And then to see yourself as a Black individual, or to see one of your ancestors in that story, to make it more relevant and relatable to you. And it's so funny, I cannot find it in my notes anywhere, literally. But I remember that was a conversation surrounding it.
And, you know, I think kind of going along with what you're saying, it's like passive is aligned with school.
Yeah.
Active is aligned with education.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So now just kind of getting into the African pedagogy, I had to do a little bit of research. Because I want to make sure I kind of know what I'm talking about. But also, it was something that I never have been inclined to research. You know, it's not something that is talked about when I was in my schooling years, even in college. Or, you know, it's just something that has never kind of crossed paths with me too much before. Although we do see a lot more Black Americans or African Americans starting to do the homeschooling option. Specifically, African pedagogy is not something that it's not something that is familiar to my ears. So I felt like this was a good opportunity for me to do a little bit of research and kind of like teach myself a little bit. What I gathered was that it is more community-based and more hands-on. I understood it to be the objective of it is really just sinking us as a people, as a collective, back to nature and back to a spiritual level. And it's kind of like when those things come together at the foundation, everything else, like the logistical things, like the math and all that kind of practical life kind of stuff, just kind of comes out of that, like it sprouts out of that. That's the vision I got in my head when I just kind of was reading something about it. The nature and spirituality was like the foundation. So you could think of like a flower pot, right? That soil is like the nature and the spirituality. And then what stems from that, the plants that grow out of that, is everything else that you will be learning about, your math, your science, your communications with people, how you even communicate with yourself, your experiences and all those things. So that's how I understood the African pedagogy. I'm a visual person. So that
yeah, me too. I was following all
okay, good. I was like, I'm wondering if this is starting to sound, you know, but yeah, so that's kind of the image that came to me when I was researching it. And I could definitely see that clear relationship between this pedagogy and homeschooling. Because with homeschooling, like you had mentioned before, it allows your environment to be flexible so you can kind of move in your comfort. And when you're comfortable, you're more receptive to the information. But not only that, you're more hands-on and actually in it and being an active learner. And so that's where I see the connection between the homeschooling and the African pedagogy. It's just more community-based and hands-on, and like you're actively learning. What I did come up with in my research for this, I feel like it wasn't really necessarily outlined as like the five principles of African pedagogy, but they were like, you know, sub paragraphs of each one. The first one I came across was like the critical need for an African identity and Pan-Africanism, the re-Africanization, which is African culture and values, adoption and transmission, Black nationalism, community control, or like institution building, mm-hmm. and then conceptual framework, and Blacks attaching themselves to African culture in all forms, so in all levels. Can you talk a little bit? I know you had brought it up that night, and that's kind of what caught my ear as well, too. Can you talk a little bit about African pedagogy and just like your views on it and just, I guess, what you understand it to be?
Yeah, sure. I actually appreciate the research that you've done on African pedagogy. Mm-hmm. And it seems as though wherever you look did a really good job at just delineating some keywords. Mm-hmm. And some keywords that you mentioned was spiritual, nature, right. community, nation building, right. institution building, what have you. So kind of going back to just your understanding and your metaphor or your metaphor of the flower pot. I really like that. Because when I was, when I used to teach, when I would teach the social structure and like its various components and what comprises this entire order that we find ourselves in, I would liken it to building a house.
Ah, okay.
And so, and I would even use something similar to the flower pot. I've used the flower pot one before, which is another thing, you being visual and us also using very similar analogies, especially the visual
part, right,
because you said I'm very visual, that I would argue is so indicative of your African consciousness.
Oh, right.
Yes, because if you think about what they call the Medu Nature, mm-hmm. Which is the language system of the ancient Egyptians, who are actually called the Kemites,
right.
If you look and so the Medu Nature is really what the Greeks call hieroglyphs.
Right.
But if you look at them, what are they? They're like little pictures.
Yeah, definitely. And they all knew what they meant.
And they all knew what they meant. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so what I'm saying, it's not, from my view, it's not by chance that you are visual.
Okay, right. Okay, yeah.
It's not by chance that you are visual. And so going to what you were saying, you were essentially saying that at the root, mm-hmm. right, is the spiritual, connecting with the nature, connecting with the self. So you have this like synthesis going on. And so then when one approaches, you know, different subjects, they have that sort of lens through which to learn that material.
Right.
So you are all like almost there.
Okay.
If you could actually take those subjects mm-hmm. right? And embed them in the actual roots and stems itself.
Okay.
That there is really no separation between physics and your body. There is no separation between math and cosmology in the universe. Right. And which would suggest that there's no different, there's no separation between that and astronomy.
Right.
And so there is no real distinction between spirit and science.
Right, right.
As African people, we practice a spiritual science. And in fact, there are so many things that we as African people do today that's so spiritual. Some folks might say, you real passionate.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you know, you get real excited or they tell you to calm down. That's your spirit radiating.
Right. Very true.
So of everything that we do is very spiritual. And so when we look at the pyramids not only symbolize the great architect, but when you go in, it symbolizes language, it symbolizes education, it symbolizes biology and the ability to mummify bodies. Mm-hmm. It symbolizes spirituality and cosmology of how when the sun would radiate within the pyramids and activate the melanin
right.
in the mummified bodies, it allowed them to connect with higher ethereal beings, including the mummy, the soul of the mummified body
right.
itself. So my point is that none of these fields are actually separate from one another, but they are combined and synthesized and worked internally to create outward. So the architect would be the pyramid would be a leap.
Right.
The physician, the what they call the Edward Papyrus, which is like the first book. It's like the first book of surgery by Imhotep, who built like the first pyramid. Mm. Like that's just not a medical document, but it has so many other fields mapped onto that, along with spirit, along with their connection to nature. In fact, I think that nature is a major component. I'm glad that you brought mm-hmm. that up, because it really distinguishes, I think, African education from so many other forms, including Montessori. I think Montessori mm-hmm. is close in some respects.
Yeah.
There's a lot of overlap. I mean, I'm sure we'll get there, mm-hmm. but
I definitely felt that way too.
The nature is very important. Seeing oneself as one with their surroundings and having an affinity and a respect for nature is another. So mm-hmm. I would say African-centered pedagogy is just under the heading of African-centered education.
Yeah.
With pedagogy just being the method, the technique, or how you want to deliver
right.
the curriculum, which is another important aspect too. Mm. In an African-centered education, you would want the curriculum to be African-centered, where African people are telling
yes.
their own historical narrative.
It's got to match across the board.
Absolutely. It has to match. And people, and we have to, because there are a lot of critics who will say, well, you're just rewriting history, or you're coming up with these fairy tales, mm-hmm. or you're just romanticizing, you know, ancient African history, or African history in general.
Right.
But nobody's actually rewriting the history. We're actually correcting the history.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if anything, you rewrote the history.
Yeah.
And made it say what you wanted to say against us. But let's just be clear that your own, i.e. European science, your own science provides support for what it is that we're doing.
Right.
So if I say that we were the first, that we were the first based on historical documents to be on this earth in terms of human form, then, and your science is saying and supporting that, you can't really argue back and forth.
Right.
And that is where that's a very important debate about how this knowledge is being used to destroy the images of whole groups of people.
Yeah.
As a way to not even destroying images, because it's not just an image. It is your identity.
Right.
It is how you relate to the mm-hmm. world. It's how you relate to nature. So us having lived, you know, having had dynasties, each dynasty lasting for 2,000-3,000, you know, right. years at a time, clearly shows that we know how to interact with the earth, because we weren't tearing right. it up. We weren't burying waste underneath the ground where natives have been buried.
And I feel like that too, that whole dynasty piece of it is, that's that institution building, you know, that community yep. control piece.
I got it.
No, it's fine. You can, no, it's totally fine. I just made the connection. I was like, oh my God. Yes. But yeah, I totally, I agree with you there too, that if it's almost as if we can say like, this has happened in our history, or this, you know, fairy tale, or this folklore, however you want to call it, this has happened. But if it's not in a, you know, European science book, or not documented in some way, it's not necessarily a fact. It's more yeah. like, oh, this is an opinion, or like a theory, maybe, you know,
it's a myth.
Yeah. Or yeah. Like a myth.
It makes for good storytelling.
Right. Exactly. So that is something that's true. And that is interesting. I do feel like too, like the African pedagogy, like it does make sense. I think Dr. Umar was trying to do this, opening yeah. a school, but he only wanted all black everything, all black staff, obviously children. And he did want to have these principals in his school. He wanted to have the gardening. He wanted to have the reflection. He wanted to have the community building and, you know, just that black nationalism and, you know, the culture and the values, all of those different things. And most importantly is just that identity piece.
That's very,
I feel like once you have that identity piece, the rest sort of will just fall into place. You might, you know, you'll find your purpose at that point. But yeah, I think, yeah, you're making me laugh.
Yeah,
sorry. I do feel like these are important. It's just interesting to me overall, because this is something that was not ever expanded upon. So in all of my years of living, and I'm pretty old, but in all of my years of living, and from what I can remember, this is something that was not ever really touched on in the schooling sense and in the college sense. And it wasn't ever really broken down, and it wasn't ever really explained why each key component, like why each component was key, like why each principle mattered.
Yes.
So it's pretty, I don't know, I liked researching it. I can be a nerd sometimes. Yeah. So I enjoyed researching this and reading about it. And I do, you know, it's so funny. I do feel there is a similarity, with Montessori and the African pedagogy, but I'll flip it and just say that, you know, yeah, it's the African pedagogy first and then the Montessori. But I do feel that way. But with the Montessori, it's the same idea. It's like I said, it's similar. So it's the same idea where when the children are learning, it's like a freedom within structure. They're kind of given their space to explore. They have materials and works set up, you know, on the shelves in the classroom, and the kids are free to kind of just go and do what they gravitate towards. And based off of that interest, you know, many lessons are, you know, they can grow from that. And they do things such as gardening, you know, movement. Even the vocabulary is different. You know, we're not going to call it playtime where the children are playing. We're going to call it work. So that way they mm-hmm. know that there's something meaningful and purposeful behind what they're doing. And it is to the point, and it brings it back to the point what we were talking about earlier, like why words are so important and why children or the students need to know what these words mean and mm-hmm. what purpose they serve. And so, yeah, when I was doing that research and we were talking about this and, like, you know, in the book club, I was like, oh, I see some connections here. And I'm like, I wonder if that's by coincidence or, you know, and I just thought it was interesting, me working in that environment, the things that I've observed in the classrooms over time and things that I've learned about it, that it was like, okay, I see a connection and I could see how this really builds an individual. Because ultimately what happens is if you have a child who is in Montessori, especially at the early childhood stages, you know, ages from infancy up until like age 5, you know, infancy to primary, 9 times out of 10, they're coming out of that experience with confidence because they were given the space to grow and express themselves and not necessarily be put in a box in a traditional curriculum and which may prohibit some children from tapping into their true self. And just even, you know, that whole thing about the reflection piece we talked about earlier, with Montessori, the children, if they're feeling a little antsy or they're feeling like they're having conflicts with their emotions and things like that, there's something in the classroom that's called the peace table. So they can just have a minute at the peace table, think about why they feel that way. The teacher will sit there with them, or if they want to sit there alone, they can sit there alone, you know, but it's not necessarily like go on timeout and be by yourself. It's just, you know, redirecting and saying, like, okay, well, do you want to sit in a quiet space and think about why you did what you did? Or do you want to sit in a quiet space and just kind of reflect and until you calm down, you know? So I think those are all important pieces. And I think there are a lot of similarities with that in terms of the African pedagogy and just the approach to the information that you'll be sharing, you know, whether it's small children or youth or teenagers or whoever. Do you feel like, you know, with your baby, I know you said you're leaning towards homeschooling, and what do you think that experience will be like, you know?
Uh-huh. So I'm definitely going to be homeschooling my little one. I think that it's going to be a rewarding, enlightening, mm-hmm. inspirational experience, right, where I know that our relationship is just going to strengthen and flourish through us learning from one another, right, in this home education process. But I do expect there to be challenges. Right. You know, I'm sure there might be some times where we need a break, and being okay with saying, you know what, though it's Monday and we're used to working on Monday because that's institutional schooling, right, you know, maybe we don't want to learn that day, and just take that day off. And so I think that might be a challenge, though, because, and I say this because moving into the learning process and you're getting dirty and being in the, you know, being in the weeds and in the trenches, you know, I'm sure that there might be moments where I'm like, you know, is she learning everything that she should be learning?
Yeah.
What else should we
do? Right.
You know, I can imagine situations like that coming up and just reminding myself that she's learning precisely what she needs to know. In part, you can see it based on her own pace, kind of going to what you were saying about Montessori education, mm-hmm. where, you know, if you are perceptive and keen and very aware of your child's progress or the student's progress, then you can begin to adapt the learning to that. So they'll in part show you where they are.
Right.
But I can imagine that being a challenge. I think another important challenge, Tamika, is accessing curriculum, you know, or curricula that will, you know, lend itself well to African-centered instruction, yeah, where right. you have, you know, let's say African-centered books at the level of a child.
Right.
You know, I might have some African-centered books that, you know, maybe a more advanced teenager might be able to read, but how can I, you know, access information, you know, from, you know, that's particularly at the young kids level.
Right.
So I think that's a challenge. And also going back to what you mentioned earlier about the cooperatives, you know, being able to partner with other Black homeschooling mm-hmm. families and having something that might be a little bit more institutionalized, where the co-ops are more expansive, where it's not just me and one other family, but it might be 4 to 5 right. families where we've kind of networking through. I think getting in contact and building relationships and mutual support between with other Black home educating families is another challenge that I foresee. So I'm not right. doing this on my own, because we know that I'm not gonna be the only one, but it would be good to have that support network and for us to kind of share the demand of homeschooling.
Right.
Because
we have to enforce that in our community. Yeah.
Right. Though I love learning, you know, I might not be, you know, in tip top shape to convey, you know, let's say chemistry, for instance, to my mm-hmm. child. But maybe you can.
Right.
You know, maybe that might be your strength. And so I send my child to your house. You send your child to my house. If, you know, I'm strong in an area that you might not be particularly strong right. in. And so as you can see, let me just mention something too in these examples. Mm-hmm. That is an African-centered approach right there, is recognizing that reciprocity, mutuality, community building, just in the way of developing a co-op according to some unified principles or values, is an African-centered approach.
Yeah. And, you know, just, I was going to say, mm-hmm. too, while I was researching, you had mentioned curriculum. I didn't find any curriculum, like, in terms of books, you know, to read. So you had set the example of, like, books that may be for teenagers for this African pedagogy. But then where are the books that are on the level of children who may be 4 or 5? And I didn't find anything like that. I kind of, everything I came across literally was more along the lines of, how do I want to say this? Like a mature research, you know what I mean?
Right.
Yep. Not so much put it into terms for someone who wants to use it for homeschooling, or somebody who has children who can read it and understand what they're reading. And I thought yeah. that was interesting. It kind of makes me feel like there really is not much of a conversation happening about that. I feel like if there was, you might find other different things about it as well.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I will say, fortunately, I came across what they call the Portland Baseline Essays.
Okay.
So the Portland Baseline Essays was really a collection of knowledge and information on different disciplines from an African-centered perspective.
Mm.
So it was a team, including one of the most highly revered, one of our most highly revered ancestors, Dr. Asa Hilliard.
Mm-hmm.
He was the leader of this group to put together the Portland Baseline Essays, and it was supposed to be incorporated into the multicultural curriculum in Portland, Oregon for their school system. And at the time, I think they actually had a black male superintendent that wanted to see this through.
Mm.
I don't know how effective it was, because I think I had came across some sources that was indicating that there was, you know, obviously some pushback and book material not being delivered properly. But my point of bringing this up is that those Portland baseline essays have like a have not only a bibliography, like a list of references and sources, but there is clear description of some of the most key significant aspects of African history as it relates to that particular field.
They have
language arts, they have reading, they have arts, they have music, history, math, science, even social sciences. And so that's a really good place to start, because if I know that these Portland baseline essays were to be used like school-wide, mm-hmm. we're probably talking about young people,
right?
Primary, secondary, school age. Right. So this should be pertinent to them, and you can find that online. I went ahead and saved it on my USB before, you know, it get taken down, but yeah, that's a challenge. There seems to be some scattered resources, mm-hmm. but I hope that that's where we go as Black people, honestly, Tamika, is that we really start bringing up these issues like you're doing in your podcast, mm-hmm. Where we start mindscaping on what do we need, and let's start organizing around the things that we need, like a curriculum.
Right. I think this is, having spaces like this, like, you know, my podcast or, you know, other types of forums, I think it's definitely something that's needed and starting to somewhat take shape to have these kind of conversations. And I think the more we have these conversations, ultimately everyone will be on one accord, you know, and then it will be more received as this is, you know, a curriculum here. This is how we're learning. This is the pedagogy. These are the things. And some people may feel like, oh, that sounds kind of cultish, but no, it's mm-hmm. not really cultish, because if you think about it too, with other, you look at other countries and some of their practices and what they do, sure, they have their kids go to school and they do traditional schooling, but they may have literally a Saturday school dedicated to wherever they're at in the world. And that's, mm-hmm. there's no question about it, you know, because they're just taught on one accord and just taught the importance of knowing that. So yeah, I do agree there too as well. Yeah, I feel the same way. Like now, you know, my kids being in school and I'm just seeing information that they're getting when I help them with their work. Sometimes I'm like, they're teaching this? Or I'm like, well, that's not how it went. What's this here? This is not how the story goes. And it winds up turning into something where I'm like, okay, when you finish your homework, we're going to do some more work. You know,
that's where your education comes
from. Right. And it winds up being, you know, of course they kind of grumble a little bit sometimes, but it winds up being, you know, like an extra hour and a half on what really happened, you know? So, and then they're like, well, why? And I have to stress them all the time, like, because you have to know, because if you don't know the truth, when they come around again, because it will come around again, you're not going to be able to see through it. And I said, it's important that you need to see through it. They don't really understand all that just yet. But, you know, I feel like if I say it enough, one day they'll be like, oh, I got it. Like, you know,
they will. I could never understand why my mom would refuse giving Kroger, you know, her number, or like Burlington, her zip code. Like, I used to be like, you're so paranoid. Mm-hmm. But once I started, you know, educating myself, I began to see. Now I wonder why she was, you know, very protective over her information. Mm-hmm. And so it will click for them with experience. That experience, that lived experience, is gonna light.
Right, up. Right.
They'll see it. It's all gonna catch up. It's all gonna come up to them. No time lost.
Yeah, exactly. Even now, I find it just me, you know, if I'm reading something and I'm like, oh, let me Google this, you know, and the information is presented so differently than what really happened. Mm-hmm. And it boils down to that point of like, okay, who's telling this information right now? You know, who's the author of this particular information? And that also becomes an important part of it that comes into play. So yeah, my kids, sometimes they're just like, oh God, sometimes they're like, oh God, here we go. Cause they know what gets me going. And they're like, oh boy, mm-hmm. you know, they're like, can we just finish it and be done with it? I'm like, no, guys. Okay.
You can't sleep with that deception on the brain. I must replace.
Yeah, definitely. Especially right before you go to sleep. That's right. Kind of when your body like reprograms itself in a way. You got to get the right stuff in there before bed. But yeah, that's just one of the things that I experienced as a parent with my kids. And, you know, my oldest one kind of gets it a little bit, but the younger two are just like, yeah, okay, yeah.
So. Yeah. And your oldest one,
So he's starting to get it. He's starting to get it. Yeah. Although this day and age, you know, the big talk, like what you said, the difference, the two different words, vocabulary words now of this generation, it went from different to diversity. And so this day and age now, present time, it's like there's so many levels to diversity. Even with diversity, you have to be careful. And so when I'm telling my oldest certain things, you know, I got to like, okay, I got to figure out like, which level of diversity are you at, you know, when it comes to what you're learning in school and, you know, what you're hearing on the streets, you know, what you're hearing with your friends and those conversations and what you're seeing on TV, what you're seeing on YouTube and all those different things. There's so many different outlets, so.
Yeah, that it's Dr. Hilliard called, you know, that the play with the words and the concepts, like you said, like what does this really represent behind mm-hmm. the scenes? He said that those issues, these euphemisms, lead to conceptual confusion, right. You know, and it's absolutely true. You will start supporting things that are actually working against you, you know, calling yourself a minority mm-hmm. works against you. I would argue that diversity, even trying to play around with mm-hmm. that term, the reason why you got to play with it like that is because it's not straightforward.
No.
You know, a lot of the words we use are, it's like they're fluff. They almost feel meaningless right. in a lot of ways.
And also, too, it's almost like a little bit of a slippery slope. It's kind of like, whose diversity are you talking about, though? And that mm-hmm. and that really matters.
Or even when I think about when you said who's diversity, I'm like, you know, well, who is diversity? Right. Because diversity is like you're using this term to basically characterize me, not necessarily to characterize a context. Mm-hmm. And when they say diverse, oh, the place is diverse, they're talking about, especially depending on the context, it's like a code word for Black mm-hmm. people. A code word for people of color. Oh, you know, so that's diversity, not the actual fact that there's just variations.
Right, right.
I'm calling you diverse. Right. And then the issue with diversity, you just got to let me go here to me because I just got to do it. I got to go here. I got to go here with the word diversity. So, and this is, so just mm-hmm. follow me. I used to take a statistics class like a lot of other people. Some people take it in college, some people take it right. in high school. But some of us might remember the bell curve and how that one line right in the middle of that bell is like the mean. And the mean is the average. Right. It's the norm. Right. And anything, any case within that data set, any case that deviated from that mean is considered variation, difference, diverse.
Right.
So the further out from the norm you get, we can say that you are statistically significantly different right. than the norm.
Right.
Who, Tamika, who is at the outermost regions of that bell curve? Who deviates? Who is so diverse where they're the furthest away from the norm? And who is the
right.
norm?
Right.
Diversity to me is a code word for any group of people that deviates from white people, mm-hmm. i.e. the right. norm, the average, the mean, the standard, right. the reference group.
Right, right.
So even in statistics, there is racism so deeply entrenched in it. You know, every group is compared to the white group. The white group is like God. You can't see it. So we call it the omission group. The group that is omitted. The group that is the right. reference. The group that can't be seen. That can't be defined.
Right.
But all other groups can be.
Right.
Especially the Black group.
You know, it's so interesting that you literally are just saying, like, you broke it down that way, because I'm Googling, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm playing around with words now. English is a funny language.
It is.
And I'm looking at, I broke it down from, I took off the prefix die, and I just looked up yeah. versity. And something that mm-hmm. popped up was saying, is a collection of varieties, which is interesting. Mm. And just, you know, I took Latin in high school, and I like to say I'm fluent in Latin. But just knowing what that means, it means like, die usually means like two as a prefix, like the number two, yeah. like doubled. And so it's kind of like double of a variation of varieties, but what does that mean? Like, you know, mm-hmm. so this is pretty interesting, yeah. just kind of breaking it down a little bit. But sure I completely is. Agree with you. It's based off of the norm. But who says that norm is the right normal? You know, mm-hmm. they're kind of going off of their own standards. So yeah, that's an interesting piece with that.
Right.
But yeah, that was good that you went there. I mean, it's great. I think one of the things I like about doing this too is that I feel like whenever somebody listens to an episode, and I hope they're listening to the complete episode, but when they listen to an episode from beginning to end, they are able to take away something. And I think it's these little like pieces that are put in here that kind of get your, you know, your thinking going, like those little machines in your brain, like they're getting the oiled up and they're like, oh, okay, wait a second. Like, you know, like I like those kind of moments, and I like to have people to have those kind of moments too. I don't want people to just go along with it because I'm saying it, or because, you know, I right. want them to be able to think for themselves. It's just interesting to me. So do you have any upcoming projects? I know you're working on your PhD, and do you have any upcoming projects happening or events? Where are you located? Are you in Atlanta, I feel like, or are you? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So I always feel like there's something to do there for our people. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot to do. I'm sorry. So yes, it's a lot to do, but I didn't want to go down that road. I know you are.
Oh no, that's okay. Yeah, I was just curious if you had any upcoming projects, anything that mm-hmm. anyone can look forward to you, can look forward to in regards to you. Like, do you have any lectures coming up, or do you have a blog or anything like that?
Good stuff. No, but I don't have any lectures mm-hmm. coming up, but I would so appreciate something mm-hmm. like that. Man, I miss teaching, and just, you know, obviously I'm going to have my first learner of home education, but yeah, so, you know, maybe hopefully, you know, through just more collaborative mm-hmm. opportunities, like I've been able to share with you right. and, you know, hopefully others who might be listening, Hopefully I'll have some stuff on my agenda. I actually do not have any social media.
Okay, wow.
At this point, I do, but I, right. So actually it was Justin Blue who got me on social media after 10 years of not being on it. That happened this time last year.
How did he
year.
Do it? I'm curious.
So him and I used to go to the same mm-hmm. school, you know, Georgia State, and we were riding the bus back to the parking lot to our cars. And as soon as we got off the bus, he was like, "Hey, let's go live." Cause he knew I'd been kind of like, you know, it's, you know, not like I just been apprehensive right. about getting on and kind of stalling and whatever. And, you know, he was like, "We're going to go live. You want to do it?" And we already was having great conversation. I was already at a high frequency right. just in my spirit. And I was like, "Yeah, let's do it." And just how elated and thrilled I felt just seeing, because, you know, he has all these followers. So I'm like seeing them all sign in and like, right. they're like, you know, saying things about me and supporting me. And at the time, you know, I was kind of going through some stuff, you know, kind of feeling lonely and down. And so just feeling so much love. And so I got on and I maintained it for a few months. But I haven't been on since February. Okay. So I don't have any social media at this time, but I do have work in that area underway. Right. You mentioned a blog. I do want to start mm-hmm. a blog. I've been kind of just compiling my resources and content. Right. So when the time is needed for me to launch stuff, I already have some okay. stuff that I can put out. But my email address is the best.
Okay.
Should I say that yeah. now?
No, nope, you can share it. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So email address is S as in Sam, C as in cat, WELLONS @gmail.com. So it's scwellens@gmail.com. And I know most people out there might be like, an email, they might be hesitant, intimidated, apprehensive, mm-hmm. might be like, this is just too direct for me. But honestly, I'm very personable. I hope that you can, you know, kind of feel me through the airwaves. And I do look forward to working with people, collaborating with folks, especially folks of like minds and who are right. inquisitive and curious. Right. And so reach out. Don't let the email address stop you. In fact, that's how I was able to, you know, share this opportunity and space with you.
Yeah.
Using my email. And within one day, because I take my email, you know, very seriously. Yeah. You know, so I respond to
I was going to say, I have a piece about that, like with emails and technology and social mm-hmm. media. Mm-hmm. And my thoughts behind that are because I have friends and I have family who don't have any social media at all up until this very day. And they refuse to get it. And I understand why. And at the same time, but I'm like, don't you want to be connected? They're like, folks can pick up the phone and call me if they want to feel mm-hmm. connected, you know, or they can send me an email or they can send me a text message or, you know, they just don't feel the urge to put themselves on a public platform. And I highly understand mm-hmm. that. But so that kind of just reminded me of that when you mentioned that you hadn't been on for years. And I was mm-hmm. like, yeah, you know, it's funny how there's so few people left like that in the world because everybody's yeah. on it, whether it's all of the platforms, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, like Twitter, all of them, or whether it's just one or the other, but somebody's always got at least one. And it's weird that it's done like a flip to where like when you hear somebody say that they don't have it,
it's like,
yes, it's almost like unheard of, like, oh, she said that, you know? So
right. Like how do you
right,
live?
Exactly. So that was interesting when you had said that to me. I remembered my friends and some of my relatives and just the other piece too about like your email address. Because even though email is part of technology, and it is important to have an email address, a lot of people will say, what's your social media if they want to connect with you and not your email address. I remember, I think this was my second episode or the third episode for this podcast series. When I first started recording, I talked about how I feel there is, everything's got its beginning and maybe not its end, but its phase out. And I feel the same way with like social media. Like, it's a great tool. There's so many things you can do with it. It connects people. You can build your business on it. You can just stay in touch with family. You can just post selfies all day. Like, you could, whatever you want to do with it, you can do with it. But I do feel at some point it may have a phase out or a die out. And what's left in that technology realm after the social media is gone? You have
everything that the folks in control could ever want.
Right. And the thing that's left too is just your email address. Good old fashioned email address. When you said, I just have my email, I was like, yeah, that's fine. That's totally fine. Because, you know, even if social media went extinct tomorrow, people could still touch you, you know, they could still get in touch with you. So that was just interesting to me. Like, when you had said that, like, I only have my email address. And I was like, okay. But I was like, you know, it's still valid. It's not part of like a conversation. Like, I'm going to email you, but it's definitely something that's still acceptable. So,
I think it just becomes so formalized. Mm-hmm. You know, with the advent of social media, where things are more informal and conversational. So, you know, somebody's like, ooh, email. Like, I don't want to be, you know, acting like I'm on a job interview. Right. Like, dear.
Exactly.
No,
and it's so funny because when I reached out to you to see if you wanted to do this episode with me, I'm like, how do I start this off? You know, or, you know, what should I say so I don't come across, you know, and for me anyway, I prefer, you know, I text and I phone calls and all that stuff. But honestly, for some things, I feel like just real energy and real conversation is necessary. So sometimes me sending emails on my end, I get a little weird because I'm like, I don't even know how they're going to take this message. You know, like, I don't know how it was going to come off to them. I could type it in my head and totally have it mean something, and they may read it and take it a completely different way. So that was the thing when I had reached out to you and I was like, oh, what do I say? And how do I not sound creepy? Like, you know, I just met you. You don't know me, but guess what? Like, you know what I mean? Like, how do you not sound that kind of way? But I guess you just learn people and you just learn how to do it. But so I don't really have anything else to say. I thought this was a great episode that we did, and just touching on these important pieces that I think hopefully whoever's listening, they really got something from this, whether they have kids or whether they don't have kids. Definitely something for them to think about. And I think this is also something that should be pushed in regards to just like everything else. You know, people want to push, you know, equality and equity and healthcare when it comes to Black women in healthcare, or, you know, all these different things that we have to go through just because of the color of our skin. I think this should be right on that list. But we've got a laundry list. This should be added now too.
Absolutely.
But I enjoyed recording this with you. And if you don't have anything else, I don't have anything else. So I just want to thank everyone for tuning in, whoever tuned in. And I hope you all got something from this. And like I mentioned in the podcast, like, do your own research. You know, don't just take our word for it. Do your own research. Challenge yourself to thinking and opening your mind and just seeing what you can learn. So until next time, everyone, peace and blessings. Thank you, Steph.